This is the BBC in Naples.
Tel Aviv.
Perth. Accra.
Wherever you are, you're with the BBC.
You're listening to KPFT, Houston 90.1 FM.
Comings in
Michael Perry is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he will be dead. This is Execution Watch. Texas no longer has public hangings, but we'll witness the legal homicide by lethal injection of Michael Perry in Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world. Execution Watch host Otis McClay, legal analyst Robert Rosenberg, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Gloria Ruback, and special guest Dr. Daniel Wirt, a Houston area physician and activist who questions whether lethal injection is as painless and humane as proponents say it is. The Execution Watch begins.
Good evening, and I guess I should say welcome to Execution Watch, which is kind of a strange program that we do whenever there's an execution in Texas. My name is Otis McClay, and I guess the most important piece of information is that I'm not Ray Hill. Ray is normally here, and where's Ray?
He's in Juarez, Mexico.
He's in Juarez doing some, is he just taking some time off?
He's trying to get someone out of prison.
Is he? I was just wondering, is he working on that?
Or jail or something.
Immigration.
He's working on immigration. I mean, he never takes time off. He's always doing something for somebody.
Always.
So I didn't know what
this
was.
He's a giver god.
Yeah. We have with us Robert Rosenberg, who is a well-known Houston defense attorney. And tonight we're going to be talking about Michael Perry, who is being executed tonight for a murder, some stuff he committed in, what, 2001?
Yes, 2001. And it was three murders, but he's on death row for one.
Yeah.
Which is the mother of one of the boys who was murdered as well. And the charges arose out of I guess not just an attempt, but the stealing of two automobiles from the Stotler family out in Montgomery County. And then Mrs. Stotler's body was found in a crater lake, which I guess is somewhere out there. And the two boys were found in the woods. And what has been going on in the case, at trial, Mr. Perry was represented by Stephen Taylor and Dan Cantrell.
Hang on one second, okay. Robert, because we have Gloria with us. Hi, Gloria. I don't hear Gloria. Do we need a push speaker? Okay. Now we hear her.
Gloria.
Hey, how are you?
Well, I'm upset. I'm angry.
Okay.
I don't know what words I can say on the radio.
I guess you are at in front of the walls there.
I'm in front of the walls. The media has walked in, family or friends of Michael Perry have gone into the death house, so the execution is proceeding. So the Supreme Court turned him down. I'm not sure when, but not that long ago this afternoon. So the 222nd execution under Rick Perry, the 461st execution in Texas is about to take place.
We are a leader. Tell me about who's there. Is anybody around?
Folks from Huntsville, folks from Houston. What country are you from? Denmark. People from Denmark are here. And we have a wonderful group of journalists or videographers from France who are here.
Huh. Interesting. And what are they? So, they're just kind of.
I'm not sure who. There's a few other people. I'm not sure who they are.
Trying to figure out what we're doing in this country.
Yes, I guess so.
All right. It seems to be working.
Well, Dorothy, that's here from Denmark, has been a long time supporter of Thomas Miller L. when he was on death row here, and she's
right.
here visiting him right now. So, whoever's right. listening to Execution Watch on your HD radio or on your computer should. And I just talked, by the way, I just talked to people in Washington, D.C. who are on a hunger strike against the death penalty.
Oh, wow.
In front of the U.S. Supreme Court building, they called to see what was happening, and they are. And then I also got a call from the state capitol where people are protesting. So there's the execution is not going unnoticed.
Well, that's cool.
Dorothy, would you like to say anything to the radio? KPFT.
She what?
Would you like to talk to the woman from Denmark? Just a moment. Hello? This is Dorothy.
She's
Hello.
Hi. What can you tell us maybe what is the general impression of the state of Texas and in Denmark with regard to?
I'm sorry, Robert wanted to know what is the general impression. What's your general impression of Texas?
Is it the friendly state?
Tough state. They don't have any mercy. They don't have any. Well, they got their own sense of justice, and that's apparently revenge and killing, and the. No progress here. It's really tough to get any results here. They're still continuing their killings, and it's not doing any good. I'm just hoping that it's going to be abolished one day, the death penalty, and we're going to continue fighting it.
Well, yeah. What were you going to say, Robert? It's hard for her to hear.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was curious how. Is that the impression of the United States in general, or just of Texas?
Can you hear him?
Yeah, my impression of the United States in general.
No, I said, is that the impression in Denmark of the United States in general, or is it really?
Comparing to Europe, it's very different when it comes to the justice system and the death penalty, and it's not about rehabilitation; it's just about revenge and. And they don't think about why the crime exists. They just want to punish people, and it can't be hard enough. Of course, it's worse in Texas than in some other states, but it's still a very big difference between Denmark and Europe. And we have less crime in Europe.
Yeah.
And though we
Interesting.
Punish less. So it should show the United States that that's not the way to go. But I don't know if they're going to or open their eyes.
Would you say that the level of violence, not just the number of crimes, but the level of violence related to the crimes is even...
I didn't quite get that.
He wants to know about the level of violence, maybe not the number of crimes, but just the kind of general level of violence.
Well, the level of violence is very low compared to the U.S. We don't have any guns. I mean, guns are banned, so I guess that makes a big difference, and we have a good... health system that takes care of people who are insane and shouldn't be walking the streets, and we have a better social system when you that you can live even though you don't have a job, and it's in general I would say the levels are higher or the standards are higher, and I think that's part of the reasons why we don't have so much crime. It's because people are in general taken care of, but of course some things are getting worse too over there. So,
yeah, well,
right.
So it depends, of course, but in general, I would say it's
Well, thanks. Thank you for being here.
Okay.
Thanks
a lot.
You
want Gloria again?
Yeah, and Gloria will get back. You get back to us later, right?
Okay. You don't want her now?
Okay. That's okay. She'll get back to us later.
Okay.
Thanks a lot. It was nice talking to you.
Actually, her comments kind of. Well, you know, we didn't even know she was going to be on, fit the Perry case quite well or address the issues in the Perry case, because Mr. Perry was, you know, adopted when he was an infant and spent I guess his adoptive family tried the best they could, but he was acting out in a violent way from a very young age, was sent away to special group homes and, you know, various forms of confinement, and really got no treatment because they said he wasn't mentally ill enough or this or that. And
I noticed that this came up more than once, a number of times, and clearly there was a pattern that this kid was not being dealt with appropriately, because he continued the same pattern.
He did, and I think it also, you know, it goes back to, I don't know if many people recall when they used to have the 10 o'clock news, they would try to get families to adopt a child with a, you know, some kind of very sad story attached to the child. And the state of Texas placed a lot of kids in homes without giving the families full background on what the kid had endured in its earlier home. And there was a lot of litigation because some families took on kids that, without knowing it, were, you know, time bombs waiting to go off.
Right.
Where they were attacking other kids in the family or the parents or killing the pets. And in this case, during the post-conviction proceedings, the attorneys that represented him did all the work that the trial lawyer should have done and discovered the fairly deep history of mental illness that ran through Mr. Perry's biological family and his mother's drug use for almost the entire time she was pregnant. And unfortunately, though, at trial, his lawyers didn't even try to get the medical records until the adoption records until the trial was already on its way and underway, and really had no time to develop any kind of mitigation evidence that might have prevented him from getting the death penalty if the jury had heard the whole story.
What I found interesting in reading it was the constant statement that he would act out in some way, and they would take him to the, quote, appropriate authorities, whatever they were, and they would end up determining that he didn't fit in to a category that would allow any kind of further treatment.
Right. Well,
again and again.
Which I guess in Denmark maybe they don't have that system to get rid of kids. And, you know, the state didn't want to assume any responsibility. I mean, as I was reading it, I'm thinking, like, this poor family, they take a kid in.
Right.
And he's, you know, what do you do? You know, and you have no medical history on the kid or his family. And if they're dependent on some kind of state agencies to assist them, that they just weren't there. So I mean, one of the reasons that I, you know, when people sort of feel like they can confront, that they can confront me or other attorneys that do this kind of work as representing despicable people who don't deserve anything, even a trial, I mean, one of the things I tell them is really the Michael Perrys of the world, we knew that they were going to end up on death row when they were children.
Right.
Or they were going to end up dead. And we didn't do anything as a society to take care of it and prevent it.
Right.
And that seems to be what the case is here. I don't know. I mean, I wasn't there, but from reading all the stuff, that's what it appears on. And another thing that's really kind of odd about his case is just Monday, the Supreme Court reversed the case on ineffective assistance of counsel.
Really?
Yeah, because his lawyers did not investigate the possibility that he had organic brain disease, which is exactly what Mr. Perry supposedly has. And then yesterday, the state of Texas called off a execution at the last minute.
That was to pardons and paroles? Or the governor?
The Court of Criminal Appeals.
Oh, okay.
So that it could be sent back to the trial court for a determination of whether he's mentally ill and not competent to be executed. And while Mr. Perry is probably competent to be executed and that he understands what's happening, it's just, you know, this is kind of an example just this week of how random and
right.
scattershot the whole process of carrying out the executions is. I mean, you would think 2 days after the Supreme Court stops an execution because the lawyers didn't do exactly what the lawyers in Mr. Perry's case didn't do. They don't care today. So
it was interesting that the people today were witnesses about Kagan's confirmation. And at least three of them were talking about essentially that the Supreme Court is changing the law. I mean, the Supreme Court is, of course, it's just generally reviewed by one justice, right? Who's on duty at the time.
In this case, it's Judge Scalia.
It's Scalia, right? Because he's the Fifth Circuit.
Right. But, I mean, everybody has an opportunity to review it. And as I've said before on the show, it's not like when it gets before the Supreme Court, they've never heard of the case before and they have no familiarity with it. I don't know the exact process, but I feel fairly certain that there's been some kind of staff attorney who has been assigned to the case for years, has been following the process. And, you know, but the case also represents sort of, it's not that the Supreme Court is changing the law, it's that they are inconsistent in the way they apply the law that they themselves, you know, enunciate one day, from one day to the next.
Is this the breakfast rule?
I don't know.
Depends on what you had for breakfast?
Who knows what it depends on? I don't know what it depends on, and I don't think anybody knows what it depends on. I think it's fairly certain that if you kill two teenage boys and their mother, whatever problems there may have been with the way you got to death row just don't mean a whole lot. And in fact, in Mr. Perry's case, the federal courts at least have made excuse after excuse for or overlooked what are clear errors that were in the state court findings, which the state court findings prepared by the district attorney, and then they're just rubber stamped as they go through. Without the judges even bothering usually to mark out the word proposed that the DA has put in the title.
Do you think this has something to do with the crime itself and that starts filtering through to people's attitude?
I think it definitely has something to do with the crime. I mean, one of the tests for, let's say, ineffective assistance of counsel is whether or not it caused prejudice, and would the result have been different had there not been effective, you know, had there
in
not
other
been
words, was the counsel prejudiced because of the nature of the
crime?
Was
the defendant prejudiced by the nature, by the failure? If the lawyers had done the job they're supposed to do, would the result of the trial have likely been different?
Right.
Well, that's impossible to say because, you know, who knows if they'd done what they should have done. There are certainly many instances around the country where defense lawyers do their job and tell the story of Michael Perry and his from the time before he was even born in such a compelling way that at least one or two jurors may vote against the death penalty, in which case it won't be executed. But here, I believe, in Texas, there's just an acceptance that if somebody kills somebody else, in particular younger people or women or, you know, older people, you know, weaker, people who are perceived to be weaker, then the court is going to assume there's no prejudice because the people we elect to be in the state court judges, I mean courts, don't believe there's anything wrong with the death penalty and believe probably more people should be executed. So how do you prove to them prejudice when they are already so biased towards the death penalty? You can't. That's an impossible burden because they don't see prejudice. I mean, you know, in his case, Edith Jones was the one who wrote the opinion, and back in the 90s, she published, I think, two articles in the State Bar Journal that she didn't believe there should even be habeas proceedings anymore.
Really?
As I recall, I mean, I was kind of stunned about the articles, and so I've tried to find them on the State Bar website, but I can't find them, but I believe she did.
It sounds to me like the title of that article would be "The Law Never Makes a Mistake."
Well, that's her attitude, and that's the attitude of a lot of them. You know, the Supreme Court has never ruled that an innocent person should not be executed. Actual innocence is not a federal constitutional right. Now, Texas does have a claim for actual innocence, but under federal law, we don't. And if the courts decide, if Judge Scalia decides that trial looked pretty fair to him,
Right, the innocence
then
wouldn't be an
so
issue.
So what?
But the innocence is never considered in the appeal, is it? I mean, generally the appeal is going to be
in
about
a direct appeal.
Issues.
Innocence would not be considered, or shouldn't be, because it's really about errors and rulings on evidence or motions and that kind of thing. In a habeas proceeding, which deals right. with constitutional issues, how could you say it's not cruel and unusual punishment if you're going to execute an innocent person?
Right.
But then maybe because you're not really punishing them because they didn't do anything, you're just executing them.
All right. Refresh me. I'm unclear on the changes in habeas that happened under Rehnquist.
Which, I mean, there are changes all the time.
Well, there was this whole shortening it and getting it, reducing it. And,
that's under the Anti-Terrorism Act.
Because habeas was
which went into effect during the Clinton administration under a statute that was passed called the Anti-Terrorism Act of, I think, 1996. And that was in... What they did is they... Which is not complied with, at least in Florida and California. Under the Act, if the state wants to prevent... What was happening, to the extent that... people on death row or in prison at all could find attorneys to represent them. Usually they would have to find them attorneys willing to do it for free. They would often file successor writs, which meant that they would raise one claim, that one would be dealt with, and then another one would come up because maybe another lawyer stepped in and said, well, why didn't you do that? Well, under the current law, any claim that you want to assert and a habeas petition must be done within a year of the conviction.
Right, okay.
And then once the Court of Criminal Appeals, this is the Texas procedure, once the Court of Criminal Appeals makes a determination on the state habeas, then it goes to federal court. And if you didn't raise the claim in federal court, then you're typically barred from raising it again. I mean, raising a new claim that had not been raised in state court. They say you didn't exhaust the claim in state court, which was one of the issues in Perry's case, dealing with the jury charge and the issues of mitigation. And the court said that they failed to raise it in the exact way in federal court that it had been raised in state court, so they waived that claim.
In other words, it had not been raised.
Right.
Because the form it took in the
It had not been the
was...
exact precise language. There is a proceeding, and in fact it's happened recently in a case that I'm aware of, where the court sent, I mean, and they do send it, sometimes the federal court will send it back to the state court if there's new evidence, let's say with like the DNA lab mess. In fact, a case that I handled, the Franklin Alex case, that he was executed on March 30th, went back. It was already in federal court when the DNA stuff came up. And since it was in it, we were unable to have discovered it before, during the original habeas, this federal court, against my wishes as his attorney, sent it back to state court. I had hoped that the federal judge would keep the case, and because you can argue that it's futile to go back to state court, which I truly believe it is. But, the judge didn't think it was futile.
From outside, from somebody who is not deeply involved in this, which I am not, I watch this as an observer,
right,
and just basically marvel at the insanity of people who say they're trying to reduce crime and then do everything they can to increase it. Because, I mean, we do have evidence that violence in the justice system begets violence in the streets, and I think she was saying the same thing from Denver.
Well, it does. I mean, look at what happened with, it was in the New York Times, the Professor Gates at Harvard, who, was arrested
right.
off of his front porch.
Right.
And they supposedly put together this blue ribbon panel to examine how that happened.
Well,
and of course, they found it was Professor Gates' fault as well as the police officer. Well,
Okay, I think it's Gloria's with us.
Huh?
Hi, Gloria.
Hey. Oh, my God. All of a sudden, we have a downpour.
Huh. Well, you are, you know, doing a great job there, and it takes a lot of dedication.
What, Otis?
I was saying you're doing a great job. What happened? Did the people come out?
Well, the execution is over.
Okay, so Michael Perry is...
Michael Perry has been
is dead,
lynched.
I guess we say. You know, he's now
state of Texas.
Right, dead but still warm.
Oh,
and I was this grisly process where they take the body to the funeral home so that people can still feel him and say goodbye while he's still warm.
You know, even the Huntsville funeral home has gotten really ugly. They're now limiting the number of people that can go in to the funeral home.
Do they have to use that particular funeral home?
Do they have to use that particular funeral home?
Yes. They have a contract with the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. Even if you have your own private funeral home, come to the Walsh unit. They will not release the body, but only to the Huntsville funeral home. It's like this sweetheart contract.
So the state pays, and then the family picks it up if they want to move it somewhere else?
Yeah.
Yeah. This. So,
and the last time, when David Powell was executed a couple of weeks ago, I went to the funeral home, and they said, is your name on the list? And I'm like, what list? They said, well, your name has to be on the list. And so then somebody, one of his friends from Austin said, well, now they're only allowing so many people in, but you can take my place. So I got to go in and David and hold his hand and tell him goodbye. But I wasn't supposed to because I wasn't on the list.
You weren't on the list. Yeah, it's interesting that as these executions proceed, which are supposed to be to prevent further crime, they're supposed
to
be examples
to the rest of the society.
And of course, we hide them more and more and more. They're being hidden. What is the purpose of this? You know,
revenge.
Yeah, there's a
well. You know, it's like
for being poor and not being able to afford a good attorney.
Yeah, and I mean, there's so many things. We spoke on the monitor with somebody who was talking about crime. One of the things we know about crime is that the thing that's the most deterrent is quick, certain punishment. What they've done is, if a guy breaks his parole, they'll say, okay, we're going to send you back for 2 days this Saturday. And that is worse than fighting over it for a year and then sending him back for a year because he's missing his kid's birthday party.
Right.
And that's real punishment.
It's very
certain,
disruptive.
And it's 2 days, so it's cheap. I'm sorry, what are you're pointing? Elizabeth.
Talk to Gloria.
Yeah, I am.
Okay.
I'm including her in a conversation. What do you want me to say to her?
I'm on the radio.
Just tell me. What?
Well, I was talking to the husband of Thomas Miller-El, one of the fortunate people who got off of, I mean, the wife of Thomas Miller-El. One of the fortunate people that got off of death row.
Right.
She and her friend were
right.
Here.
After how many years was he on? I mean, he was like number one.
Thomas went to death row, I think, in 86.
Yeah, because he was there as long as I was on the prison
show.
So
a couple of 20, how long was he on death row? Over 20 years.
Yeah.
Back in the 90s, he had execution date after he'd come to Huntsville, they'd give him a stake. And then 30 days or 90 days later, they bring him back, and they did that over and over and over again and really tortured him. It was unbelievable.
All right.
To Thomas.
All right, Gloria. Well, thanks for reporting. Thanks for enduring the rain and just the general thing that we're doing here.
Okay. Well, thank you all.
I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. And... we were talking about Michael Perry, who is now no longer with us, so he will no longer be a threat to society, if indeed he was the threat. I'm not sure. I'm Otis McClay. I'm sitting in for Ray Hill, and we're here with Robert Rosenberg talking about the law and about Michael Perry's case. And
Go ahead. Well, I was going to say, I from what I've read about him, it does appear that he would have been a continuing threat to society,
yes.
But
yes.
Only because there's no place for him to take him out of society where he would be a threat. In prison, my guess is he wasn't much of a threat because he had that confined situation and rules to follow and appropriate supervision. So
kind of what I'm saying, though, is that he's somebody... you know, that it raises the question, the philosophical question about our societies. Do we have a responsibility to people who don't fit in? You know,
I personally believe we do have that responsibility, and that we shouldn't just kill our mistakes.
Yeah.
You know, and it's always been kind of curious to me how the pro-life group is usually also the pro-death penalty group.
Yeah, it's interesting, and, isn't it? We'll save the baby so we can kill the... Dave Atwood is with us. Hi, Dave.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Where are you?
Corner of Woodhead in West Alabama, near St. Stephen's Church.
Okay. All right. And what's going on there?
Well, we had a little protest against the death penalty. Had about five people that were there.
Okay.
And which isn't bad considering it was raining pretty hard.
Right.
And so we we're pretty much done now, but we had a good group out there, and I think we're all a little wet.
Yeah. Any response from cars or passersby?
Yeah, we always get a number of cars that respond. And I think everybody that responded today, we have lots of cars. I mean, I don't know, hundreds, maybe a couple of thousand. I don't know. Many cars go by that corner at
right.
the time. And anybody that responds has responded in the positive, you know, thumbs up.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's our typical, I mean, every now and then you'll get somebody who will.
Then you need to make a big sign that says, vote. Write your congressman. What?
Right.
Well,
Voting is the big thing. If
yeah.
we don't have a change.
Voting is. Robert had something here.
Is Bill White running on a repeal the death penalty platform? I doubt it.
I doubt it. I don't know
what
he.
I couldn't quite hear that.
He was saying was Bill White running on a repeal the death penalty platform.
No.
But
no.
I
guess
I don't think anybody running for any office in Texas. That's the problem.
Right.
Yep. Nobody's going to raise it. Until somebody can raise it and say, look, it doesn't work, and it costs a lot of money.
The only reason that the only time they raise it is to prove how tough they are.
Yeah.
And to show that they're all in favor.
We're glad to spend your money so that I can look tough.
Yep, right.
I mean, that's it. And, you know, I mean, there are states, what is it, five states that are looking at getting rid of the death penalty because of the expense.
New Mexico did.
Right,
New Mexico did. But that was, you know, that was Richardson.
Well, what is it? People there like the death penalty.
I might mention about Bill White. I do think, although he's not running, that's not part of the platform and probably never would be, I do think he's got a different attitude on it than Rick Perry does.
Well, yeah.
And I think things would get better if White was elected. But I don't think that he's going to be the person that will go out there and run a campaign or... even if he gets elected, do an awful lot on that. But I think he would be more careful about what happens. And, you know, he may allow a few good things to happen if he was governor. So I would certainly choose him over Rick Perry when it comes to this issue.
Okay.
I would choose him for many reasons.
I don't
agree. Robert, right. Right, exactly. All right. Dave, thank you for the vigil. And the webpage, the... Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, TCDAP.
TCDAP.org.
Yeah, and it's on the Execution Watch and under links. If you go to the Execution Watch page under links, you'll find a bunch of links there. And the Texas Coalition, which has been around for a long time and been very active, is on there. Interesting stuff, a lot of stories.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dave.
Well, thank you.
Later.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Dave Atwood, and standing in the rain to help abolish the death penalty. Now, Robert will be back in a few minutes, and the featured interview is with Daniel P. Wirt, M.D., and he's a Houston area physician who's been working for years to abolish the death penalty and improve health care. What a strange thing for a doctor to be doing.
Well, you know, there was. They will go to extraordinary measures to keep someone alive
right.
in prison so that they can then execute them the next day.
Right. Okay, we got to go to this interview. Elizabeth wants to stick to the clock.
This is something that. Actually, Ray Hill did this interview.
Yeah, it was the real interview.
A little while ago, and it's on tape.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't going to say that. I was just going to...
It'll be evident.
Okay, rock
this
and roll.
This is Execution Watch. I am Ray Hill. You're listening to this on KPFT HD2 channel and on executionwatch.org. We've been joined in studio tonight by Dan Wirt, a local physician. Dr. Wirt is a friend of the show's, and like the rest of us in the studio, is not exactly neutral on this issue. We've asked Dan to come in and talk about the chemistry of executions. Hi, Dan.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you for coming down. I think that a lot of people just don't understand what actually happens in the process of execution by lethal injection. In Texas, we do all of our execution by lethal injection. How does that happen?
Essentially, all states have adopted lethal injection as a means of execution, and that's done with a combination or a series of three different drugs. The first is a very short-acting barbiturate called sodium thiopental, and that renders a person unconscious, or that's the intent. There are significant questions about whether it actually does always reliably render the condemned person unconscious. So the intent is to induce unconsciousness or what's called surgical anesthesia. And after that has happened, the second drug is a muscle paralyzer called pancuronium. And that causes complete paralysis of all voluntary muscles, including respiratory muscles. But it does not affect your level of consciousness. So that if a person were given pancuronium, they would not be able to move at all, not blink your eyelids, not breathe, not anything, but you would still be perfectly conscious and aware, and of course you would suffocate. The third drug is potassium chloride, and in high concentrations, that's toxic to heart muscle, and so it causes the heart to stop.
Is there any variation in the dosage? I mean, what affects that? Body weight, age?
Yes, and in fact, there are significant variations, and the pharmacokinetics are complicated. There's a whole science of pharmacology, but. There are very significant variations, and those variations have created a lot of questions about just exactly how humane and painless execution by lethal injection is. And in addition to the variation, individual variations, there are a lot of potential problems in administering these drugs, and we can get into more of that later. But just one more thought about individual variation. In fact, there's variation among states, for example, about how much sodium thiopental is given initially. Some states use 2 grams, and some states use 5 grams. But even in the case of 5 grams, which is supposedly, in many cases, would be a massive overdose, even when 5 grams are given, some individuals will still be breathing after up to 9 minutes. Which raises significant questions about the level of consciousness before the second drug is given.
If this is not being given by somebody who is medically qualified to supervise it, is it?
No, it's not, medically trained people have basically been barred by multiple professional organizations from participating in executions. And this includes the American Medical Association, the nursing associations, anesthesiology associations, and others.
So the person actually there is not qualified to supervise it, therefore they can't do a running analysis of what is happening.
Well, not unless when you go to the hospital and to get your gallbladder taken out for gallstones, that you would consider having the warden or one of the guards administer your anesthesia. I guess if you would have no objection to that, then they're qualified.
Of course, the assumption is that the person they're executing is guilty, because the courts have said that, and the appellate courts and the authorities have not granted a stay. But they're in a room alone with people that are not medically trained. There's frequently difficulty finding a vein or creating a stationary connection to the arm. All of this, doctor, sounds very forbidding to any kind of medically explainable circumstance.
Well, I agree with you, there's direct empirical evidence that this is fraught with multiple problems, because most of the problems have happened. And you're right, it can be very difficult to establish an intravenous line. Every physician who's trained knows that's the case when they're called late at night and need to get an IV started, and it can be very difficult in many different patients, most of whom have not abused their veins, by drug abuse and so forth. Many people who are being executed do have a history of, past intravenous drug abuse and have extremely difficult venous access. Any alternative, such as more invasive procedures like what's called a cut down to actually expose a large vein, is totally outside the expertise of any personnel involved in this process. So, as a matter of fact, there are multiple sites of problems, multiple potential problems, and which have basically all occurred in the administration of these drugs, getting adequate venous access is only one of the problems. But speaking of venous access, do I have time to talk about a specific case?
Sure.
Okay. Mr. Diaz in Florida in 2006, the typical procedure is to try and start two IVs. Well, they started the IVs in Mr. Diaz and administered the drugs, and he didn't die. So this is after half an hour or so, and so they gave some more. And when they give more, they typically are not giving more sodium thiopental to induce unconsciousness. They gave more of the other two drugs. After Mr. Diaz finally died, but then the coroner, a medical examiner, examined the IV sites and determined that neither of the catheters were in veins, and that all of these drugs had infiltrated into the soft tissues. Now, that in itself would be really quite painful if you've ever had what's called an infiltrated IV. But in this circumstance, it's unlikely that in an infiltrated if the sodium thiopental didn't go into a vein, it would not have produced surgical anesthesia or unconsciousness. And therefore, to a scientific certainty, what killed Mr. Diaz was the dose of pancuronium, the muscle paralyzer, when he was fully awake. Fully awake and conscious. So just imagine in your mind not being able to move a muscle, not your eyelids, not your mouth, not being able to cry out and say, "My God, I'm in terrible pain," and to be suffocating and fully conscious and not able to do anything about it. It's a very claustrophobic feeling. And if anything is cruel and unusual, that would be.
Has there been any academic research to all of these problems?
Well, there has, but in typical fashion, the state of Texas and other states have hindered that research because not allowing investigators access to the data which they collect. There's a prominent group who has, however, tried to collect data and do research on some of these issues. And at the University of Miami, Dr. Konieris, who published a very controversial paper in a very prestigious peer-reviewed scientific journal, medical journal called The Lancet, one of the premier...
British stuff.
One of the premier journals, medical journals in the world, and it was very controversial, and there were some significant criticism of the study after it was published, and it found the conclusion. They found, Dr. Konieris and his group found, inadequate levels of thiopental in postmortem blood. After executions, suggesting that that in fact there may have been incomplete surgical anesthesia or incomplete unconsciousness before this second drug, the muscle paralyzer, was given. There were a number of criticisms about that the science in that study, but there are complicated issues of pharmacology and pharmacokinetics. But the bottom line is that it indicates the need for more research, but. In fact, doing the additional research could well be considered unethical.
We have Dr. Dan Wirt, a local physician, who is joining us today and is discussing the chemistry of execution. We're going to have Dr. Wirt on a future program to talk about the ethics. He explains that those two things are inherently tied. And so on a future Execution Watch program, we'll have Dan back. Dan Wirt, medical doctor, physician, a Houston area friend of Execution.
Thank you, Ray. And Ray is in Juarez getting somebody out of prison. At least that's what I hope he's getting done. My name is Otis McClay. I'm sitting in for Ray for this Execution Watch. Today, the state of Texas, in our name, killed Michael Perry, who we were going to talk about the case a little bit. I'm here with Robert Rosenberg, who's a pretty well-known defense attorney in Texas and works in this area. He's a regular visitor to Execution Watch. I hate to say regular because the coroner says, hey, let's put the mic away a little bit, and that way he can move around. It will make a lot of difference. Let's just talk real quick about this. What happened with this Perry case? So what he did and what they did. And
well, what he did is they broke into this house out in the Montgomery County. They shot the mother, took her car, went back a little bit later to get the other car, kidnapped the son of the woman who was killed, and then one of his good friends drove him out to the woods and shot them. And then they, at some point, Perry did it with one of his two roommates, was what the state alleged. And then there was another roommate who, at some point, came along with a young woman, and they claimed that they were shocked and appalled at what was going on, and so they left. And at trial, again, Perry was represented by Stephen Taylor and Dan Cantrell. I really am not familiar with Dan Cantrell, but Steve Taylor has been the subject of several articles in the Austin American Statesman as someone who regularly takes on death penalty work and does very little on behalf of his clients.
Did they make a? Was there an appeal based on an ineffective counsel?
There was a habeas claim for ineffective assistance of counsel at trial during the course of the jury selection, which usually lasts about 3 weeks in these cases. They subpoenaed records from the adoption agency that had placed Michael Perry. And it took several days for the adoption agents to come in, and I had found the language that they used. Anyway, they argued that his attorneys argued that this was vital information for them to have to prepare his case. Yet they did wait till the trial was already in progress
before they even asked for it.
And it wasn't a secret that he had been adopted and had a long history of various mental problems. So they hired a psychologist who had all of 2 days to interview him and do whatever she could. And she wrote them a letter that she believes that he has organic brain damage and full testing needs to be done. They apparently had an opportunity to have a continuance at some point and chose not to. And some who were down at the courthouse would say that there are some lawyers who just don't really want to take up a lot of the court's time because they're not going to get more appointments if they spend a lot of time trying these cases. So why not?
Yeah, I guess we should point out that in Texas, we don't really have a indigent attorney system. We have a system where guys will get appointed to be the defense attorney by the judge.
Well, but there is a approval process for people to get appointed to be trial counsel and then people to get appointed to be habeas counsel. And so supposedly they have demonstrated competency. But the fact of the matter is the level of competency required by even the Supreme Court of the United States is so very low that, you know, if you're breathing. You're competent. And in fact, people like, you know, Judge Jones on the Fifth Circuit in the case where the lawyer fell asleep.
Oh, right. I don't want to say Joe Cannon. Do I want to say Joe
Cannon? It is Joe Cannon, yes.
Who's famous for that?
He became notorious for that. He was the subject of a front-page Wall Street Journal article for that.
Back when they were doing investigative journalism.
Right. Yeah. No, I was trying to think of the name of the defendant. You know, the judge who had heard the case, I mean, that case made it all the way through the state courts, and they found no problem with the sleeping lawyer. And then the conviction was thrown out at the district court level, And
I want to say it was then, Perry, what's his name? Perry, do you remember him? Okay, never mind. Another.
His name starts with a B. Okay. It's not Burdett. Anyway.
Okay, I don't know.
Anyway, the original panel ruled against him, as I recall. And then there was a rehearing where it was they were reversed. And I believe that they were reversed because a lot of the judges must have been embarrassed, because by that time it had become an international cause celeb that in Texas it's okay for the lawyers to sleep through a capital murder trial as long as you can't tell from the record
if it was
important parts of the trial.
As long as you get the conviction.
You know, yeah. No, the reasoning of people like Judge Jones was, well, we can't tell from the record if he slept through the important parts,
right,
or were it some minor parts.
So we'll assume it's a minor part.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so how do you determine what's a minor part? I mean...
Well, that's what we were saying before. I mean, this is... It seems to me, you know, speaking in kind of an abstraction, that this is all evidence of the state arrogating to itself the right to kill people, and it's not going to give it up, period.
No. In Texas, it's not as much as...
I guess Texas Texas is an extreme offender in this area.
You know, I hate to be the resident curmudgeon, but...
Well, somebody's got to do it.
Somebody does have to do it. And I, at the age of three, it became me. As my family would tell you. But anyway, as much as the Dave Atwoods of the world and the Gloria Rubinics of the world wanted to be different, I just don't see it's ever going to be different unless we just run out of money. And that would be the only way it's different, is if it just becomes too cost prohibitive. But we would rather spend money doing this than educating kids or providing mental health care to people like Michael Perry when he's a very small child and needs it.
Yeah, and obviously has an issue.
Right.
I mean,
hire better CPS workers who can take kids out of abusive families. You know, there's all kind of things they could do with the money besides spend it on lawyers like me, who, according to many people, must make millions and millions of dollars doing this work because, you know, it drags on forever.
Well, when you're the police...
$4.95 an hour.
Being policeman to the world is expensive.
So anyway, the courts were not impressed by the ineffective assistance claim. They were not interested in... Another big claim was that the roommate who says he fled, you know, was one of the key witnesses for the state. And so there was what's called a Brady violation, which the regular listeners probably have heard of before. And that is when the state suppresses evidence that could be exculpatory or inculpatory, or impeachment evidence, not inculpatory. But anyway, what was suppressed is that this kid had a tacit agreement, okay, to testify against Mr. Perry, that he would not be prosecuted for robberies that they were doing. And in Mr. Perry's case, the state had him testify he didn't have any agreement like that, and that he was just an innocent bystander and didn't even know that they were going to commit any crimes, including the robberies. But in the other guy who was tried for capital murder, the same kid testified and admitted that he was more than a passive, innocent bystander, that he had an active role as the lookout man, and under the law of parties in Texas, he's equally culpable.
Right.
And the courts were not bothered by the fact that in two different trials involving all the same people, the state put on completely false evidence in one of the two trials. So,
interesting place to leave the end of Michael Perry. This is Execution Watch. My name is Otis McClay. Our producer is Elizabeth Stein. We've been talking with Robert Rosenberg, and Ray will be back next time. Thanks for listening.
From the best diet to protect our hearts to the safety of the drugs we take. At Health Check, we make sense of the latest medical research and look at how it can help us to live a healthier life.
Join Claudia Hammond for Health Check. Listen online anytime. Health Check on radio, on TV, and online at bbcworldservice.com/healthcheck.
I'm Rajan Datar, and every weekend I hand the airwaves over to you. So if you feel strongly about what you hear on the BBC, then SMS 447786 2020 06.
This is the BBC in Beijing.
Kampala.
Reykjavik.
Delhi.
Wherever you are, you're with the BBC.
You're listening to KPFT, Houston 90.